starting with the toleration of slavery in any capacity. He punished many who had flouted the law and hid behind their connections to the Five Counts by confiscation, imprisonment, and sentencing to various terms in the Iron Band. In fact, after the Restoration, the Iron Band grew enormously as rebels chose service in the wilderness. The Iron Ring around the penumbra grew as new towers and fortifications were built and staffed. The thousands of slaves taken in the previous years were freed by ducal edict, and Anguin deployed an army of law brothers to enforce any conflicts in favor of the enslaved. In some cases, he paid for the difference himself to settle a case out of confiscated funds. Repatriation took much longer, of course, but once slavery was no longer permitted in Alshar, the agricultural economy began to straighten out. A few large confiscated estates were used to house those unfairly taken, and some began to make their way home. Once again, caravans began to cross Gettermore, as overland trade resumed with the rest of the five duchies. There were other relocations that were less desperate. Pentandra and Arborn took residence in the Tower of Sorcery, traditional palace of the court wizard, where they could raise their three new daughters in security while the new government coalesced. Lord Hans and his family largely retired from public life and became quiet counselors of the new regime as the remnants of the old were hunted down. House Furtius began a close working relationship with Princess Radin and her nascent intelligence service, first rooting out the last of the rebels, and then proceeding to establish an internal state security apparatus. In general, the folk of Alshar, both north and south, were thrilled with Anguin's return after such a contentious period. And while Radin was not well-loved, she never, publicly, took issue with those who still associated her with the murder of Honora and Lenguin. She ran her court with dignity and decorum, quickly adopting Alshari styles of dress and participating in the social life of the capital with enthusiasm in preparation of the coming wedding. As for my former apprentices, Rondal was deeply involved in the administration of justice to the rebels and the reordering of an ultramar after the Restoration, helping his future in-laws with adept use of magic and wisdom as he served his duke. Tyndall, on the other hand, largely remained in the north, haunting Verone and Vanador. He lent his aid to Markadine and the other Wilderlords to help keep the Wilderlands functioning through the winter after the court left the capital. Both lads managed to establish new chapter houses of the Astasi Order in Alshar, one at Timberwatch and one at an estate outside of Fallas. There were enough new knights to staff both after Olam Saheri. Astaroth and Gideon were installed as the barons of their respective lands and began the consolidation of Anguin's power base in Gilmora. And the road between Verone and Fallas was once again open, patrolled by the Duke's men every inch of the way. It was more revolution than restoration, but thanks to Gatina's completely unanticipated attack and fiendishly complex plans, Anguin regained in a season what dukes, wizards, and gods had all considered a work for generations. Never underestimate what a girl will go through to impress a boy. I enjoyed my time with my family as winter approached. While there were still plenty of dangers to consider, I had what was most important to me, and I spent every moment I could cherishing it. Alia continued to improve, though in strange fits and starts, and she even warmed up to the idea of being a mother again. At a certain point, with little encouragement, she resumed being a wife again too. That was an interesting experience, and no, I don't want to speak of it. Something should remain private. Much of my time was spent preparing for the new Berrian Council. It was taking more time to organize than I preferred, and the date of our meeting had been delayed twice. But then there were a lot of things going on in a lot of theaters. For my part, I was to name the three human magi representatives. That would be me, Pentandra, and Terlaman. But I was also preparing a number of proposals of action for the council to consider. Of highest priority, were searching for the Aronin's daughter and her ancient arsenal, to keep Korbal from gaining it, if possible. Scouting the new situation within the penumbra was also of import. Since the Goblins' civil war, there might be opportunities for us to exploit. And, of course, the dragon issue was always pressing. Even more so, now that I had two eggs in my possession, I was curious how the Alcaalan would react to that news. While I was sketching out some of the details, I was interrupted in my workshop by an unexpected visitor, Sir Festaren. He had finally returned from his errantry and wished to resume his position as assistant castellan. The lad looked tired. More, he looked no more a lad. There was a fresh scar above his left eyebrow, and a maturity in his eye that had been missing before. He'd also started to grow a beard, though the results were as yet ambivalent. "So, how fared your errantry?" I asked, after I poured wine and sent word to Sire Kay. "Well," he admitted, "though not always in the ways I expected. There were bandits and rascals. I fought a wicked knight who was oppressing his peasants. That was interesting," he said, drumming his fingers. "I had on as a mercenary for 2 weeks during a private war, and led a rather successful raid," he said, without sounding terribly happy about it. "All in all, a good summer," he decided, "but I want to go back to work I know best. I am most satisfied by serving Sevendor, and you, my lord," he said resolutely. "I love my lands, I love my home. As engaging as errantry is, I find I am not restless enough to sustain it." "And that other matter?" I asked, prodding. "What of it?"
"What of it?" he asked. "I think I shall see how things lie between us for a while. As delightful a companion as Dara is, she is not the only woman in the world, and I've seen what happens when commitment is hastily made and quickly regretted."
"You think you would regret marrying Dara?" I asked, surprised.
"Perhaps, perhaps not. But the matter is important enough to warrant more study, don't you think?"
"That is for you to decide," I chuckled. "You seem to have your own head for the matter. I merely wished that you take a moment to consider before starting a chain of events that you both might regret."
"Yes,
you are welcome to resume your duties," I acknowledged, "and may return to your old quarters at your convenience. I had Kay keep them empty, on the chance you might return." "It might be the only thing familiar about Sevendor now," he chuckled shyly.
"I go away for a few months, and come back to find the pond empty, the mill and bathhouse gone, Brestel Tower burned, and a dragon corpse being butchered in the fields. Thank goodness I sought adventure."
"You missed a lot," I agreed, "including the return of Alia in some small way. But it's the same old Sevendor. City of enchantment, veil of magic, bakery of the gods. It survived a dragon attack, a war with the Warbird, and Tyndall and Rondel. With your help, it might survive a few more years." That night, just before bed, the inevitable happened when Dara showed up at the door of Spellmonger's Hall, an unhappy expression on her face.
"You did it again," she said,
her face screwed up in anguish.
"Festaren's back."
"I swear I had nothing to do with that," I promised. "But I thought you wanted him back."
"He's back, but he's changed his mind," she said miserably.
"I went to see him and kept expecting him to
ask me something, and he didn't."
"Well, I thought you didn't want him to ask," I pointed out. "You were a working woman, remember? No time for marriage and such."
"Not now,"
she snorted, "but I never said I wanted to be a nun for the rest of my life. Only when I went to see Fess, he was just polite.
Just polite.
Not like the old Fess at all," she pouted. "Meaning he didn't sprawl at your feet and beg for your affection?" I asked wryly.
"Meaning he was distant and cordial, not warm and affectionate,"
she huffed, crossing her arms.
"Then he told me about his adventures in Errantry this summer,"
she said sullenly.
"He was in a few fights. And there were girls,"
she said softly. "He's a handsome knight," I pointed out, "and he's a man of good character. That's bound to attract attention from the maidens." That observation didn't soothe her.
"That doesn't mean he should pay attention to them," she said savagely. "Not if he was... thinking about Dara."
"In the lad's defense, you haven't been particularly clear about your feelings," I pointed out.
"It would be bloody helpful if I knew what they actually were,"
she snarled.
"Ishi's tits, master. Why is it I can master the intricacies of Imperial magic, teach myself how to be a falconer and then a skyrider, lead troops into battle and run my estate, yet I can't seem to master the simplest things about boys? Perhaps because you view them as boys, Dara, I said gently. They are men. They risk their lives and look to their future, a future that is all too brief. They do not have the patience to await you to make some decision. And yes, when you do not make your feelings known, you give them every right to consider another course of action. I made my feelings known to Garrus, she pointed out. Look how that turned out. When I finally caught up with him in the Wilderlands after the battle, he didn't want to exchange two words with me. Was he rude? No, but he acted as if we'd never... Like I was a... He treated me worse than a stranger, she said, hanging her head. All I ever told him was that I was not attracted to him, that I didn't want to marry him. Not that I rejected his friendship. Yet he felt that rejection keenly enough to relocate to an entirely different duchy and distance himself from the source of the pain, I observed. His heart was set for you, Dara. That isn't your fault. But him seeking solace from his wound, that isn't his fault either.
He didn't even ask about Frightful, she said,
a tear running down her cheek.
He acted like I was just some regular old military commander, not an old friend.
It sounds like he isn't willing to be your friend anymore.
You want to know what's worse?
She sniffed.
Natia thinks I was an ass for treating him that way, which has nothing to do with my leadership, she added defiantly. But she's so upset she took her entire wing to the Wilderlands. Permanently,
I heard. She accepted Duke Anguin's standing invitation, and most of her riders are Al-Shari. They are needed there, I pointed out, and if she was divisive to your command...
Well, she took Gareth's side, she continued, so good riddance. Let her go. I hope they'll be very happy together up in the cold, dark north.
Then a horrific thought occurred to her.
Flame and Ash, do you think they're...
Dara, such speculation does you no good, I said, as soothingly as I could without sounding too patronizing. I wish I had better answers for you. I know Gareth was unhappy with your answer, so he moved along. Festaren was unsure of your answer, so he postponed asking the question, because he had no indication of what your feelings are.
How can I know what my feelings are when I don't have any control? She demanded. I can't entertain such things when I'm apprenticed, she said, looking at me accusingly.
Ah, as for that, it is a matter that can be rectified. I have already discussed it with Master Thinraddle, and when we go to the palace for Yule, he will have your examinations prepared for you, both written and practical. Master Loico will administer them.
What?
She asked, genuinely confused. You're going to sit for your examinations in a few weeks, Dara. You're going to pass them easily, and then you will be a journeywoman, free to make whatever decision you choose about your life. She wouldn't be able to use her apprenticeship as an excuse anymore, I thought to myself.
Journeywoman?
She asked, mostly to herself.
You mean, I wouldn't?
You would still be a lady of Sevendor, indeed, the Hawk Lady of Westwood, my vassal. But beyond that, you would be a practicing mage in your own right, free to make your own decisions about your life, without my consideration.
But even if I did want to, Fess's, he's not. Oh, Master, why do you make things so complicated?
She snarled and stomped off.
Honestly, I thought she'd be happier about the news.
Mage-lord, Ruderal said formally, as I was writing in my daybook in the afternoon a few days later.
Count Moran, Prime Minister of the Duchy of Castor, to see you.
I sat bolt upright. This was unexpected. Bring him to the study at once, I commanded, as I stood and whipped off my smock. I had reasonably decent robes on underneath, but I was hardly dressed for visitors of rank. I paused to grab a couple of goblets and a bottle of wine, as well as slap my wizard's cap on my head, just in case he'd forgotten. Moran entered my study with some hesitation, and he had not taken off his gloves, though he carried his hat, nor had he given his cloak to Ruderal. That was disturbing.
Baron Minelan of Sevendor, called the Spellmonger, he said, formally giving me a bow. I bear a message from His Highness, Duke of Castal. Your liege, he reminded me unnecessarily.
I stood, This was not a casual meeting. Yes, Count Moran. I bowed in return. How can I be of service to His Highness? I return from Wilderhall, where their Highnesses are wintering, he said quietly. After great deliberation, His Highness deigns that you share some portion of responsibility for the destruction of his palace and the death of his son, the heir, while your station places you beyond simple justice, and their Majesties have prohibited His Highness from pursuing other options, he said, swallowing nervously. His Highness has elected to exercise his ancient right to express his displeasure. I beg your pardon, I asked, confused. Baron Menelon of Sevendor, you are henceforth banished from the Duchy of Castal, exiled for a period of 3 years, he pronounced, though it troubled him to do so. You are to be beyond the frontiers of Castal by Brigger's Day, and not return, save for official court business or your responsibilities to the Arcane Orders, until Brigger's Day, 3 years hence. He's taking away my barony, I asked in disbelief. My domain. His Majesty prohibited that, Count Moran admitted. You have broken no law to warrant such action. Yet the prerogative of the Castali Dukes has always been to use exile and banishment to express their displeasure when more severe penalties weren't politically expedient. He's sending me away, I said, trying to understand. You and your family, Count Moran explained, for 3 years. You may reside elsewhere and appoint a steward for your domain. During that time of exile, no appointments you make will be valid, no orders or writs are binding, nor may you increase your military forces. Your designated steward will administer your feudal obligations on your behalf. Your neighbors will be strongly discouraged from testing you. In essence, your rule here will be in abeyance. For 3 years. How dare he? Your Excellency, Moran sighed. I am sympathetic. Despite our past acrimony, I feel His Highness is acting out of grief and frustration, not wise deliberation. He has grown stern in his melancholy, and Princess Armandra is nearly as distraught. If it wasn't for her pregnancy, I fear she might contemplate some dire end for herself, he said gloomily. He broods, my lord, he broods and he fumes. He is awash in pain, yet he refuses to seek any solace. Nay, not even drink, he said, shaking his head. Yet exile? I asked, still angry. It was not his first choice, Moran said. It was the least damaging punishment his advisers could convince him of. He wished, originally, to strip you of your lands in hopes that you would resist. I snorted. He does realize that we just killed a dragon here. Sevendor is not defenseless. Nor is it properly yours, after this spring, Moran said, handing me the scroll with the decree. This is the only course he can take that King Rad and Queen Radin cannot effect. It is a wholly ducal prerogative, enshrined in Castali tradition and custom. King Rad has himself used it several times when he was duke. Indeed, Princess Armandra came to your defense, to the extent that she persuaded His Highness to give you until Brigger's Day, and not make you and your children travel during the depths of winter. Out of respect for her devotion to Trigg, Allmother, he added. I'll be sure to pass that along, I said absently, as the implications of Tavard's snit became clear. What happens if I refuse? Then His Highness is within his rights to declare you a rebel, Count Moran said, and make war upon you, a war that King Rad would be forced to support. Punishing a disobedient vassal is a lawful application of force, he reminded me. If one were to ask me, I would suggest that His Highness secretly hopes that you will, indeed, refuse. I don't think it's much of a secret, I sighed, realizing the bind he put me in. I take it there's no method of appeal. None, agreed the Prime Minister grimly. Banishment is at the sole discretion of the Duke. It has been oft used to remove political opponents from court, he explained, and I remind, my lord, that many things can happen in 3 years. Yes, 3 years of Castal without the spellmonger should be interesting, I grumbled, particularly if there are more dragon attacks. I do hope Prince Tavard does well with those, I said darkly. His Highness is aware of the risks, Moran said simply. He is willing to entertain them. I'm not so certain he does, I said mildly. He understands that this will have political repercussions as well. His chances of securing assistance from the Arcane Orders in the future may well prove difficult. That is not a concern of His Highness, Moran said miserably. He sees little benefit or value to magic. Tell that to his troops who ate from magically provided rations, I mused. Very well, Count Moran, your message is received. Please let His Highness know that my family and I will depart Sevendor by Brigger's Day, without resistance. May I ask where you might go? Well, there are four other duchies out there, I pointed out. I'm sure one of them might like to have the most powerful wizard in the world in residence. No doubt, frowned Count Moran. His Highness sees the Magi as a threat to the royal family and a long-term threat to the stability of the kingdom, whereas his tenure as Duke has been a model of stability and wisdom, and it was magic that allowed his father to build the throne he will inherit, I snorted sarcastically. He's lucky the gods love irony. I'm sorry, Theron, Count Moran sighed. I tried to talk him out of it. I really did. We all did. But he is convinced that you are the source of much of his pain. He will not entertain any other explanation, and I fear it will impact his ability to rule, he added worriedly. I stared at him. You know, that is suddenly not my problem, I realized. If His Highness feels the realm is better off without the benefit of the spellmonger, then he doesn't need my counsel, I decided. But I do wish him good fortune with the challenges ahead of him.
Challenges?
Moran asked, curious. Oh, certainly, I nodded, but he doesn't need to hear them from me. Thank you, Count Moran. Your message is delivered. I bid you a safe journey to your next destination. Understanding the force of my dismissal, Moran was wise enough to bow and leave without further word. Shit. I was being exiled, and the little prick was entirely within his legal right to do so. I sat there and fumed about it for an hour before I discussed it with anyone. Then I spoke with Pentandra, Terlaman, and Astoril about it, mind to mind, before I finally went out to speak with Sire Kay. I want to appoint you steward, I informed him when we sought quiet for discussion in the chapel and showed him the parchment. You run this place better than I do anyway. If you'll accept, I added. Minilin, I could not refuse, he said, frowning fiercely, but I am powerfully moved by this injustice. You were in no way at fault for the actions of Korbal. The very idea is a slight against your honor. I am no more knight than I am a baron at the moment. My honor is not my primary concern. Unless I wish to make war on Tavard, this must be accepted. Do I want to make war on Tavard? I asked. Without just cause? Nay. He sighed, disappointed. He actually considered the matter. I was flattered. Then I must go into exile, and you must rule in my stead as my steward. I thank you for taking on that responsibility. Minilin, surely there must be something you can do, he said, his brow furrowed. Perhaps if you speak with King Rad, then I would further alienate my liege. I pointed out, Tavard has made his decision. He's put me in a position where I can either resist and go to war, or comply and go into exile. As war would be, a disaster for this domain, not to mention the duchy and the kingdom, then I will comply. The spellmonger will go into exile. Chapter 78 Count Palatine. The shock at the news of my exile was like a clap of thunder over the land. After surviving the dragon and getting their baroness back, the Sevendori were reluctant to see them go. Actually, reluctant doesn't quite cover it. There was an aggressively loud party that was encouraging me to resist and rebel. Folk who had recently withstood a dragon attack and the plague of giant wyverns were not likely to shrink from a few knights and archers. The war magi in town particularly wanted me to challenge the exile. When it became clear that I was unwilling to risk all of their lives for the sake of my honor, the angry shouting died to angry murmurs. That at least allowed me to get some packing done and start winding up my affairs. The good news, Master Guri said,
When I'd informed him at the lodge, he said, "By the time you get back, your castle will be mostly finished. We should be working on the towers and the deeper portions by then. Sire Kay will ensure your pay and your supplies are kept in abundance." I nodded. "I look forward to seeing what you produce in my absence." "Oh, we'll have the place looking beautiful for you," he assured. "Without you around telling me what to do, I can focus on the craft for a change," he said. That was a blatant lie. I left Curry and his car shack alone. "I'm going to miss you, Minolin," he sighed. "It's only a few years," I pointed out. "I'm sure by then I'll be ready to retire into my beautiful castle." "Where are you going to go to?" he asked, concerned. "Well, the only property I own outside of Sevendor, outside of Castile, is an old house in Veron. I suppose we'll head there first. Perhaps I'll set up shop as a spellmonger again." "You? Selling spells to the public like a merchant?" he snorted. "It's not a bad life," I said defensively. "Veron is a little urban for my tastes, but it's not a bad place to raise a family now. I could be quite comfortable there." "I'm sure you'd be the best merchant on the market square," he nodded, "especially with that thing floating over your shoulder all the time. Not professionally intimidating at all," he assured me sarcastically. Well, he did have a point. As romantic as returning to the simple life of a spellmonger sounded, the fact was that my life as the spellmonger was not simple in the slightest. I could no more be a simple spellmonger, keeping shop and casting cantrips for pennies, than Master Loico could hire on as a village guardsman. But ishies, tits, it sounded more appealing than court politics. The news of the exile put a damper on the preparations for Yule, which Sire Kay and Lady Estret had originally planned to be a celebration of Alia's return. But it also gave me an excellent opportunity to reward the loyal and valiant before I went away. I tried to make the best of the development, but it was painful to consider leaving so many people who wanted me to stay so badly. The least I could do is prepare them for 3 years without me. The fact was, the Sevendori would do fine without me around, attracting the attention of sea folk and dragons. Lord Mayor Bannermore had management of Sevendor Town well in hand. Sir Festaren handled the castle and domain with skill, and Sire Kay ran the barony beyond our frontiers with dispassionate justice and attention to detail. Master Olmec took care of the gardens and farms. Darrow was watching the skies and overseeing the westward. Master Ulin was running both the Abulaterion and the advanced enchantments in the mountain without me, now that the handmaiden problem was solved. The Terra Elan were well established in Hosendor under the three emissaries. And in his spare time, Bannermore and his new staff were turning the arcane mercantile company into a quiet commercial force. I had good people in place. I had little to fear as long as they were left unmolested. I was in an interesting feudal position in that my neighbours were almost as distraught about my exile as my subjects. Sire Sigilan and Baron Arathaniel and his sons all urged me to protest to the king, and offered to appeal to the prince themselves. I counselled them not to waste their capital on such a hopeless case. There was no need to share my taint in the prince's eyes. Tavard wanted me gone. His son was dead, and he blamed me. It was unfair, but it was understandable. If anything happened to Minalion, for instance, I don't think there would be a safe place for the criminal to hide. Anywhere. If that meant that I had to suffer for that perception, then spending 3 years in the beautiful Wilderlands, where Alia would feel even more at home, was not too great a burden to bear. I could help watch over the Penumbra, help Pentandra with her city, now that she was tied up in the south with court affairs. I could be useful, I knew, and I wasn't above finding lost cows and curing various poxes in exchange for a few chickens. I like chickens. Alia and I attended the Yule royal court by invitation. Among other business, it was to be the official consecration and acceptance of the dowry I'd negotiated on Radim's behalf, in preparation for a lavish spring wedding in Phallus. It would ratify the transfer of the tribute burden to the counts in the coming year. It was also an opportunity for every count in the kingdom, including a dozen southern Alshari counts who accompanied Anguin to the capital by magic in a show of Alshari strength, to exercise their newfound prominence in the kingdom's affairs.
Such a display might not have been seen favourably had Angwin not also brought 2 years' worth of back tribute, collected, Rondal informed me, from confiscated estates of the many traitors who supported the Five Counts, from the entire duchy. No one in the court was willing to disparage the presence of so many counts from an ultramar after that presentation. Prince Tavard and his bride were absent, still sulking in Wilderhall, so the court feast was actually somewhat merry, despite the absence of Count Kindine and other regular fixtures. Rad and Grendine made a gracious show of support for each oath of fealty the Count swore to him directly, and when the Alshari began their oaths last, he made a special point of praising them, including his soon-to-be son-in-law, the Count of Phallus and Ruin, His Grace Angwin, the Duke of Alshar.
"Now that the realm has at last been unified," Rad said, after he took the emotional oath from Angwin, "we can anticipate a more joyous spring than the laments of autumn we hear now. For a united realm can face the foes that challenge it, be they in the Mindens, in Faris, or in the East," he said, glancing at the ambassador of the Duke of Merwin. "While we mourn our losses, we look forward to the blessings the gods may bestow upon us in coming days. You, gentlemen, are the counts of the kingdom," Rad continued, standing and spreading his arms. "To you our defence is entrusted. Some of you took up arms directly in this very palace when that kingdom was threatened. In the coming days, as we face a dark and relentless enemy, you may well draw them again and again in our defence. Such is the honour that we bear for our ancestors." There was some cheerful applause. "Yet strength of arms alone is not enough to ensure the security of our kingdom, alas. The foe we face is devious and cowardly. To defeat him and avenge our honour dead, we must not merely be strong. We must be organized. We must be prepared. To this end, with counsel among the three ducal courts," he continued, "it is my desire that the disposition of the kingdom's defences be reorganized and consolidated. As you gentlemen contribute your tribute to the royal coffers, you will also be entrusted with ensuring the defence of your folk is adequately provided for. With the consultation and blessing of the Duke of Rhymer, I therefore establish the lands of Wenshar as a County Palatine, with Count Mesteron to be Count Palatine under the nominal vassalage of Rhymer. This recognizes the distinctive culture and political history of Wenshar, a stalwart of our realm. With the consultation and blessing of the Duke of Castol," he continued, "the three coastal viscounties will be combined with Old Castol and be established as the Castali Seahold, a County Palatine, with the venerable Count Erabacor as Count Palatine. With Faris once more in enemy hands, this will facilitate the production and maintenance of a true royal navy." There was much applause at that. Castar's lackluster naval performance had inspired plenty of strutting amongst the Alshari sea lords who'd fought against them this summer, but who had accepted Angwin's offer of amnesty. Especially with the Farisi pirates once again loose on the sea lanes, that would be an important point of development for the kingdom. I heard later that while Tavard was dead set against the idea of the seahold, Rad insisted, as punishment for his commandeering of the Farisi harbour defence fleet. It was an expensive lesson. The coastal baronies brought in a lot of taxes to the duchy, but perhaps it would persuade Tavard that his future as a great war leader was destined to be from the back of a horse, not the deck of a ship. "Lastly, I yield to my nephew, Duke Angwin, to announce the reorganization of his own newly expanded realm." Angwin came forward and bowed to his aunt and uncle before addressing the counts. "As everyone knows, my realm has only been recently restored, yet it is not undamaged. The fortunes of war have dictated that the old order in the Wilderlands will not stand, and therefore must be amended to ensure the efficient defence of the realm. Just because I have taken my rightful throne in Phallus does not mean I have abandoned my responsibilities or my overlordship of the Wilderlands, or Alshari Gilmora," he added. "But with so much pressing business south, I have decided to delegate and direct responsibilities for the defence of the Wilderlands to those best suited to bear them. After long and studious consideration, my court and I have decided to retain the summer capital at Verone as a ducal territory. But south of Verone, from the Five Rivers Valley to the very gates of southern Alshar, and encompassing all of its traditional territories, there shall be established the Wilderlaw, a county palatine, with Count Markadine named Count Palatine thereof. In the Wilderlands north of the Five Rivers Valley, from Green Hill north to the extent of my realm, I establish the Mage Law, in honour of the Magi who have fought so valiantly for the defence of the realm, as a county palatine. I name Baron Minilin, the spellmonger, as Count Palatine thereof. There was a rushing in my ears. From what I learned later, the megalith began bobbing worrisomely behind me. I only barely heard the rest of Anguin's speech. Since before my coronation, Minilin has taken it upon himself to see to the defence not just of the Wilderlands, but of the entire realm. He has loosed the chains that bound magic to irrelevancy and turned it into the sharpest of swords against our foe. In him, the ancient wisdom of the Ark Magi lives again more, for he enjoys, it is said, the counsel of Alcaalon and the gods themselves. I can personally attest to his wisdom and cunning, he continued, to an enrapt court. He is as subtle as any wizard who has ever lived. I can attest to his valour, having witnessed it myself. I stand witness to his dedication to the lives of everyone in the kingdom, commoner and nobleman alike, and I can swear an oath to the great enmity he bears our darkest foes. He added, no one has struggled more valiantly against Sherul and Korbal than he. Yet Minilin is not most adept when he is a diplomat or a warrior. He is best when he is using his magic, his craft, and his wisdom to improve the lives of the people he rules. When he had a choice of lands, after the fateful Battle of Timberwatch, in which my sire fell, he selected the least of lands, a stony domain far from the abundant vales of the Riverlands. And in that hilly little territory, he used magic and wisdom to forge mighty works. More, he lifted up his subjects until his villeins enjoy as superb a prosperity as his burghers. He took a village and transformed it into a city. He took a profession long disparaged and turned it into a weapon and a tool of great power. For the strength of the spellmonger I have found is his compassion, he revealed. He looks for the best in the folk he meets, and if he finds merit, he helps them accomplish their dreams and desires. Not for the love of gold or the thrill of power, but for the pure compassion he feels for his fellows and the joyous reward their success provides. Such character is rare these days, if it has ever been in goodly supply. But when a man of common origins distinguishes himself so repeatedly and so profoundly, it is clear that he is the man best suited to rule the wild frontiers of our country, he declared. When a man who counts the very gods amongst his confidants is available to take the lead in a kingdom destined for war, yet unprepared for it, a duke is a fool if he does not take advantage of others' short-sightedness, and I am no fool. Therefore, inviting Minilin the spellmonger to assume the post of Count Palatine will not only put a wise man in a position of authority, it will also grant him the ability to bring the knowledge and wisdom that transformed Sevendor from a destitute domain to the center of a thriving barony to the Mage Law. There he will find the raw materials for his enchantments, freed slaves, brave wilderlords, and as many magi as he wishes to encourage to settle there. It is a wild and empty country, full of promise and danger. It faces the worst of our foes in the Penumbra, it guards the best of our allies in the Colleens, and it wards the rest of our kingdom from assault and invasion from the Shadow. I can think of no better opportunity for Alshar or the kingdom than to see Minilin take his place as your peer. Let me be the first to hail you, then, as Minilin, called the Spellmonger, Count Palatine of the Mage Law. There was applause. There were embraces. I humbly came forth, got on my knees, and took the oath of fealty. And when I rose, everyone called me Count Minilin. But I barely remember it. I was in complete shock. Why does this shit keep happening to me? You just gave me half your realm, I accused Anguin later that night, as the Alshari delegation congregated in a hall outside the palace that was afterwards known as the Alshari Hall.
Why did you do that?
It's actually less than a tithe of my realm, and it was Pentandra's idea, he said with a shrug. I mean, eventually it was. We knew that Markadine could rule the remaining intact Wilderlords in the south, those whose lands were largely spared by the invasion, but the north was always a problem. Some counseled we abandon it altogether and retreat back to Verone. But why bother? He asked rhetorically, as Tyndall brought him a goblet of wine. We had people there, and not much else. So Pentandra suggested we give it to the Magi. The idea has apparently been floating around since after Timberwatch, but no one ever did anything official about it. With all of the south for me to govern now, I need people I can trust locally to ensure the security of those lands.
But why me? Why not Asterol?
He was my second choice, Anguin admitted. Count Angriel lobbied on his behalf. Telamon, too, seemed a good match. But then so did Pentandra. In truth, Asterol is more use in Gilmora than the Wilderlore. When my idiot cousin exiled you, I figured it was an ideal time to give you some place to go, and something useful to do, like you did with me a few years ago. That's incredibly generous of you, Your Grace. No, the hells it is not, Anguin countered with an easy arrogance. It's not generous at all. If anything, I'm putting an anchor around your neck. You've seen what's left of the Wilderlands. Hells, you walk nearly every inch of it. I'm handing you a half-formed lump of clay and a handful of hopes. I'm not granting you riches and glory. I have a sufficiency of both, I said dryly. No, what you grant me is a boon, when I am at my lowest. Honestly, I thought I was going to have to open up a spellmonger's shop in Verone or something. Instead, when I am feeling worthless and cast aside, you offer me an opportunity. Did you not do the same for me once? He asked quietly. I was drinking myself sick and losing every joust I fought, and you pulled me out of that and sat me back on my throne, against Grendine's wishes. No small feat there, he said admiringly. You gave me purpose and a challenge, to see my realm reconquered for my house. Because of you, that is now a reality. If you need the boon of opportunity, I'm happy to grant you the chaotic dung heap the Wilderlands has become. I don't know what to say, Your Grace, I said humbly. Don't thank me, he warned. As I said, I've hung an anchor around your neck. No doubt you will pine horribly for your home, but you must contend with the wilds of Alshar instead. There isn't a decent hall, tavern, or temple left in the region, and I believe you are familiar with the neighbors, he added. I think I can accept that challenge, Your Grace, I said, after a few quiet moments of thought. Indeed, I happily accept it. Perhaps I can recreate the success of Sevendor without the mistakes I made there. I'm confident that you will make entirely new ones as well, he chuckled. That is the lot for those who rule.
So I am beginning to see. I hesitate to ask, but what's the difference between a count and a count palatine, specifically?
That's not something they covered at Inarian Academy.
Well, as you know, a count is the senior official in charge of the defences of a particular region, Anguin explained. A viscount is responsible for the defence of a smaller region, usually. That means that they inspect the baronial castles, ensure the roads and bridges are in repair, sponsor training and practices within the county, ensure that the garrisons are properly constituted and supplied.
I understand that part, I nodded.
A count palatine has all those duties, but more. He has all but ultimate sovereignty over his county, near independent control, with only the Duke himself above him in position. And the King, now, he amended. That implies certain sovereign rights usually reserved exclusively for the ducal houses.
Such as?
Well, for one thing, you can mint your own coins, he pointed out, ticking off a list of feudal goodies I was now entitled to. You can build castles anywhere you please. You may train men without restriction. You can designate marshals of the realm at need. You may build bridges between domains or baronies at your discretion, provided you arrange for their upkeep and maintenance to be funded. You may establish what temples you wish, wherever you wish. You may establish hereditary rights and obligations, customs and laws.
You can charter guilds. You can grant arms and devices. You may manumit or change the status of a bondsman. You may nullify court findings in baronial courts at your discretion. You can pardon a man condemned in a baronial or manorial court. You have the right to grant land or seize it for military use. You have the right to extract minerals, collect timber, and harvest fish from any river in the county, or to delegate that right for grant or fee. You can charge tolls on any roads you maintain which can pass two carts side by side. You may forbid the marriage of any noble vassal of yours. You may designate unclaimed lands for your own use for hunting and herding. You may set basic prices on iron, salt, and certain implements of war. You have the power to conscript forces in emergencies for defence, as well as the responsibility to see that all able-bodied men receive basic military training. Oh, he continued, recalling some obscure bit of law he'd read, a Count Palatine also has the power to negotiate and make war with other states, as long as he informs the Duke of the results. He can demand the first barrel of any shipment of ale, wine, or beer, one horse of his choice out of every herd of 100 sold at market, and, by tradition, gets an option on a journeyman artisan's first masterpiece, if he so chooses. He can set fees for esquiring, knighting, and the practice of arms, and he can mandate up to 2 days a month be devoted to archery practice, he finished. I think that's most of it. That's a lot, I said, my head swimming. What's the difference between a Count Palatine and a Duke, or a King? You don't get to wear a pointy hat, he decided. Practically speaking, that's about it. But if you want to cobble together any other distinctive, non-pointy headgear, feel free. Counts Palatine have a lot of discretion with that sort of thing. My head was still swimming. New rights, new responsibilities, a whole new land to develop. A land where I had virtually no restrictions. That was a heady feeling. I was being made king of a realm, in all but name. My vassalage to Anguin and Rad were the only nominal responsibilities I had. Apart from that, I was free. You realize that you're my vassal now? I asked Pentandra a few moments later. You and Arborn? Of course I do, she snorted daintily. Who do you think proposed the idea? If I have to have an overlord, you are better than some I could think of, and it is rare you get to pick your own liege. It was the absolute right thing to do, she said, with utter assurance. I hope you're right. I sighed doubtfully. So, I take it I'm in charge of Vanador, then. Don't be silly. I'm in charge of Vanador, she corrected. We have over 100 houses built now, and just in time. It started to snow pretty regularly. But you can be in charge of the Mage Law and live in Vanador while you're doing it, she proposed. I suppose that works, I agreed. But as a count, am I not supposed to have a castle? Yes. You are free to build one at your discretion. On top of the anvil, she suggested. Strongly. That would be the best place. Carmella has been itching to get started on it. She already has a crew surveying. As soon as she's done with Verone Castle, she'll begin in earnest. It's going to be gorgeous, she added with a smile. I've seen her drawings. I looked at her skeptically. It sounds as if you have been planning this for a long time, I noted. I've been nursing non-stop for the last 8 months. I've had a lot of time to think and plot and plan. You're welcome, she added. Thanks, I added belatedly. It does give me something to do now that I'm exiled, and while you're busy in Phallus. I suppose it will be better for Alia, too. A few years in the Wilderlands, with fresh air and lax social customs, might be what she needs. I think it's what you need, too, Min, she said gently. I know the war is heading into a new phase, and we have to fight it. But that doesn't mean we can't live a little, too. Make a good, safe place for our kids to grow up in. In a cute little hole in the ground like yours, I teased. Oh, Antimace Croft is comfy, if you don't mind the dust, she assured. Even Mother had to admit that, after a while. Arborn likes it. But as soon as the ground thaws this spring, Carmella's crews will begin work on a real hall that we'll build over the croft. A grand hall. Just down the street, a second crew will begin work on the Count's Hall, a place for you and Alia and your household to live in, until you get the castle built. It sounds rustic,
I like rustic. It won't be rustic for long, she warned. I have plans for Vanador. Grand plans. It's going to be a city someday, Min. Hells, it already has a pretty big population. We just need the buildings and the infrastructure. We plan to do it based on the work you did in Sevendor. When we're done, it will be amazing. A real city of the Magi, like Sevendor, but on a grander scale.
It's a lovely vision, Penny, I agreed. But will Korbal allow us to see it fulfilled?
Did Chirul allow us to fall in love, get married, and have children?
She countered.
No, he just made it a challenge. We managed to do it anyway.
We'll manage to raise our little monsters in peace as long as we can.
That's about the best we can hope for right now.
You're probably right, I admitted with a sigh. Perhaps he'll give us enough time to grow old and die before he makes another move. He's immortal. He doesn't have any reason to hurry.
Except the one you gave him,
she reminded me.
He's in a decomposing body now. He'll be desperate to fix that. That could be problematic.
If he comes after the handmaiden, I'll have Lady Fallowen cut his lady love's undead nose off and send it to him, I vowed. She's eager to do so anyway, after she slew her father.
Sure, but that doesn't mean he won't try something else. We're fighting a new kind of war now, and one that might just give you the reprieve you desire. For a little while. Korbal just lost another dragon, a bunch of Nemavorti, and he's got rebellious goblins in the north. He has problems. Hopefully enough to occupy him for long enough to get our children raised.
He's still making moves, I reminded her. The undead plague is still spreading in the Westlands. He still controls the Penumbra, the Umbra, and the Land of Scars. He controls most of the swamps in an ultramar's southwest.
I'm working on Karamaz, she insisted, but I'll bet you a Kasari peach cobbler that he makes a play for the censors at Faris now, she predicted. Korbal is not sending armies our way. Not yet. I think we can contain the threat, at least for now. He'll have to consolidate power, and that takes time, even for a powerful Dark Lord. We'll use that time to continue to build our strength. Learn how to use that pretty green ball of yours, for instance, or the snowflake, stuff like that. By the time he's ready to come after us again, we'll be ready.
I hope you're right, I sighed. I could use a few quiet years in the countryside. Away from politics for a change. Some place where I can really focus on magic and my family.
That's the plan,
Pentandra agreed.
There are huge libraries of ancient texts stashed in an ultramar. The Tower of Sorcery alone is stocked with secrets on every shelf. You'll have plenty of time for idleness, going through that alone.
I suppose I will, I said, feeling my heart lighten for the first time since I was informed of my exile. It might be nice to relax for a while.
Chapter 79 The Council of Beryon.
Our first order of business must be locating the Scion of Amaraz, Master Harathel said, after we'd introduced ourselves.
The Beryon Council met for the first time in a secluded tower in Carnaduin, a few days after Yule. I led the delegation of the Arcane Orders, seated around one-fifth of a broad round table with an accurate map of the five duchies engraved upon its surface. Next to us was the delegation from the rest of humanity, Lord Arborn of the Kasari, and a temporary representative of the Valley people, who were still uncertain about participating, but were reluctant to allow action to be taken without their knowledge. Beyond him was Gurkarl, representing the Free Gavanni, a coalition of Kulin tribes who'd rejected Chirul's dark priesthood, and a few rebel tribes among the flinty hills in the northern penumbra. The old Gurthan was hale, though a bit bent with travel and greying around the muzzle. Sitting next to Gurkarl was a nearly round specimen of Tal Alon named Thane Agartas. An old and wise leader of his vast warren, he apparently represented the interests of the Tal and other species, and beyond him was Asguri, the designated delegate from the Karshak clans. The Terra Alon were present in force. Lady Fallowen spoke for them, but included Onranian and Lelastian among their number. Both had declared a preference for the larger, human phenotype, and suggested they would continue to wear it until the crisis was past. That was pretty much all that qualified you as a Terra Alon. A few within the next delegation had been reluctant to include so many perversions, as I heard it whispered. Yet the Terror Elan represented those most committed to the defeat of Shadul. They were the most enthusiastic to take the fight to the foe. If we needed action against Korbal, they were the ones who would be most likely to undertake that action. Lastly, the Alka Elan were well represented by Master Harathal, who sat at the head of the council, the executive position. He was joined by Lord Letheran and Lady Micrethiel, neither one of whom seemed pleased about their inclusion. "I concur," Micrethiel said distastefully, "but we have searched the length and breadth of the realm and found nothing. Yet it is said that she has not perished," she said, irritated. "Unless we gain some insight into where the arsenal is located, we are at a loss."
"Did not the spellmonger speak with the Aronin in the dungeons of the necromancer?"
"Aye," I answered, "and he gave the kind of cryptic response his race and house is known for. The land itself will show you the way," he said.
"Yet I see little sign of that," I said, gesturing toward the map at hand. "He must have provided more clues than that, if you had the wit to hear it," Harathal said sourly.
"My wit was intact, my lady, but his only other hint involved magic. Where might one place something that can be sought by magic?"
"Well, in a non-magical space, of course," reasoned Pentandra, "or at least a space with such a high etheric resistance as to be the same. In the belly of a dragon, for instance," she suggested.
"I doubt the Aronin placed such mighty weapons in a dragon," sniffed Micrethiel. "Yet perhaps it does give us a hint, for there are places in the world which possess the properties you describe. The island your folk call the Shattered Isle, to the southwest of Alshar, and the distant lake in the north known as Selainen. Your folk call it the Cakered Jevalar, I believe."
"The Anti-Malapar?" Terlaman asked. "I thought that was a myth."
"It is no myth," Master Harathal said, shaking his tiny head.
"It is theorized that it, and the Shattered Isle, for that matter, were both giant mountains that fell from the sky long before the Alon came here. They are responsible for the dreadful state of the landforms here, in fact."
"Would one of them not make an ideal place to put a magical arsenal?" asked Pentandra. "As they are proof against scrying, and likely unable to function in that environment, it seems a perfect location to put something magical and dangerous."
That is an intriguing thought," concurred Lord Letheran. "Neither place is easy to come to, nor would they be easy to assail. The Avalanti have always had a love of remote and barren places," he mused.
"We should send an expedition to both places," proposed Lelastian. "Arborn, perhaps you could organize a survey with Ithalia? Your folk have travelled that far, have they not?"
"Not with regularity, but we know the way," he grudgingly admitted. "We could send scouts as early as the late spring, once the northern lands thaw."
"I should be able to organize a naval expedition to the Shattered Isle," Pentandra proposed. "Duke Anguin has many naval assets. I should be able to get him to sponsor the trip."
"That would be gracious of you, Lady Pentandra," Harathal said, nodding. "Your people seem uncommonly good with boats."
"It will give Tyndall something to do once Rondol is married," Pentandra whispered to me.
We were both concerned about my former apprentices. Rondol seemed to be warming to the idea of marriage strongly, but as he grew more resolute, Tyndall grew more despondent over losing his friend to family life.
"Then it is agreed," Micrethiel said formally. "The Humani shall investigate both locations and report back to this council by next autumn. Among the next priorities on the agenda, a report of the interrogation of Mycin Amana," she said, eyeing Fallowan.
If she was trying to stare down the beautiful Terror Elan woman, she failed. Fallowan had let her grief over her father's death and her devotion to her duty to her people transform her. Indeed, her association with us, dirty Humani, was making her proud and defiant when it came to the normal Alka Elan. She was not about to be shamed by Micrethiel's archaic ideals of purity when her Terra Elan form served so well.
"She has been terribly reluctant to part with meaningful information," Fallowan revealed apologetically.
Even when extreme measures have been brought to bear, she resists. Yet in our conversation she has revealed more than she thinks. From what I can tell, the crux of Korbal's master plan involves first seizing the realm from the rightful council, she related, and then using the power base he builds here to challenge the great Rulathi and Farastamari kingdoms. That should only take 1,000 years or so, according to his timetable, she shrugged.
Kind of makes me feel all mortal and inconsequential, Talamon muttered, earning a chuckle from Gurkarl.
But that isn't all. Along the way, he intends to build his power not merely through growing armies and conquering lesser races, usurping the places of power in the realm and dominating all life, but through a series of measures he feels will establish communication and, eventually, an alliance with the beings known as the Formless.
Because the Formless, the Lastian said gravely, can potentially defeat the Vandal, whom Korbal despises.
Is he mad? Mycrethiel demanded. Did his long entombment destroy his reason? If even a tithe of what we know about the Formless is true, then even speaking to them would be catastrophic.
Only if we wished to keep good relations with the Vandal, as has been our custom, agreed Harathel. Korbal does not have that as a priority.
I do not understand, the Thane asked, in his squeaky voice. I am a learned Tal, but I have not heard of the Formless. What danger do they pose?
They are myths and legends, Mycrethiel dismissed, half forgotten even among the Vandal. They are beings of great power and unimaginable durability. Long ago the Vandal's ancestors drove them into the deeps and sealed their watery prisons so that they could never escape.
Unless, perhaps, someone is helping them from the outside, Telman observed sourly. That's what I fear, Onranian nodded. There are several weak points, even fractures around the various entrances to those ancient, impossibly deep caverns. The Formless and their spawn have not always been kept within. Sometimes one or two escape, squeezing through the smallest of openings to eventually make it to the surface. Sometimes they seek merely to hide in more comfortable surroundings and molest no one unless awakened, which has been known to happen, he said, casting a glance at Asgore. Once, a few centuries ago, the Karshak apparently loosed one such spawn from its rocky grave. It didn't go well. If Korbal should find one of those fractures, with magic and determination he could possibly establish communication with the Formless.
Why would they bargain with a mere human? Asked the valley person, curious. Or even an Alka-Alon inside a human host?
When you are trapped and desperate, do not underestimate the lengths to which you will go to free yourself,
Mycrethiel reminded. If anyone, even a human, offers you hope of escape, you will promise anything. To anyone. And the Formless were passing desperate 10,000 years before the Alon arrived here.
Longer, corrected the Lastian. The Formless predate nearly every other alien species on Kalidor. Their hatred for the Vandal knows no bounds. If they were offered the opportunity for freedom, they could not refuse. If they were offered freedom and vengeance, they'd deal with forest animals or river fish to get it.
Surely they could do nothing against the Vandal, the valley person dismissed.
Don't be so certain, cautioned Lelastian. From the Vandal's own law, some of the Formless were large and powerful enough to consume the equivalent of a modern Leviathan. It took the power of the last of the Celestial Mothers to imprison them. No power less will put them back again were they released.
How could Korbal possibly release the Formless? Lord Lethran asked, skeptically. Their prisons are miles under the deepest oceans. He could never get there.
Not all entrances to the deeps are at sea, Onranian offered. There are said to be ways, impermanent shifting and incredibly dangerous ways, to discover a crack or a chasm that leads to a cavern that eventually leads to a crack that can lead you to the outer barriers that keep the Formless imprisoned. Should he find a way to one, and should he leverage the great power inherent in Shadul, then he may well have the means to awaken those dark beasts.
He acts with a certainty that suggests he's already found at least one means, Mycrethiel observed. Then why has he not attempted it, if he has now the power to do so?
because he doesn't quite have the leverage he needs, suggested Lelastian.
Sherul provides power, it is true, but the great barriers the Celestial Mothers put into place cannot be removed by brute force. He must feel that the answer lies within the arsenal.
Legend has it that some of the greatest powers of the Alon are stored within that vault, Harathel agreed. Among them are devices which could, if the legends are accurate, be enough to negate the force of the barriers. If they are suspended, even for a little while, then we shall see an invasion of hellish creatures that make our present worries seem like pleasantries. If the spawn of the formless are anything like what we unearthed, accidentally, as Guri emphasized, then even one of them is too many.
What the Karshak found was but a minor servant, from what I can tell, Onranian agreed. The creatures in the deeps are far more formidable.
Then imagine what a real formless might do, should it be unleashed, warned Mycrethiel, and let that inspire you to search that much more diligently.
From there the conversation moved to dragons, particularly the slaying parts, and to dragon eggs, of which I had a pair. That bit of news both sobered and excited the council, particularly the Alka Alon.
It would be intriguing to have two such specimens for study, assured Harathel.
There is little lore concerning dragon husbandry left in our memory, but what exists suggests you have a powerful property, Minilan.
Not one that should be in Humani hands. Mycrethiel sniffed again. Really? Do we honestly expect a mortal to raise and tame a dragon? When we made the attempts, it could take 500 years for a trainer to command the beast. Do you have half a millennia? She asked.
No, nor do I have the interest,
not when there are others with better means and methods. Therefore I shall turn my two eggs over to the Terra Alon, I said. Lady Ithalia and Lady Varen may attempt to hatch them, if they have an interest. If they are successful, then perhaps in a few decades we may have a stronger weapon with which our descendants can continue to fight with Korbal.
The Terra Alon?
Mycrethiel asked, scandalized.
Why, they aren't even really Alka Alon.
Nor is Korbal and his Nemavorti, Talaman pointed out, yet they have no quibble with riding them. Or wyverns, for that matter. The poor Gervan's dragon, I suppose. We may be mortals, but they are not. If it truly takes that long to bring such pieces into play, then let us play without them while the Terra Alon train them for battle. Ishi's tits. It would be nice to see a dragon in the sky and not shit yourself.
You would place such potent weapons in the hand of...
By all means, Lady Fallowan said, her pretty eyes narrowing to slits.
What kind of hands do my sisters and I possess? Human hands, perhaps?
She challenged. I assure you, my lords and ladies, if my sisters' hands are given the leash to these worms, then they will be used exclusively to prosecute this war, a war I grow frustrated seeing you diminish. I know little about dragons, but I know my sister emissaries. Power entrusted into their hands is never misplaced.
But the Terra Alon,
Mycrethiel squirmed uncomfortably.
Do they need dragons?
No one needs dragons any more than one needs mosquitoes, I offered. I think it unlikely that they will be successful, but I also feel they have earned the right to try. Unless you wish to invest the time and energy of training and raising the beast into the endeavor, and then fly a dragon into battle, Lady Mycrethiel? I asked tauntingly.
If so, allow me to be the first. My boy, I asked a perfectly reasonable question,
sighed the tiny Alcan Dowager. I understand the foe we are fighting, and I understand the forces in play, perhaps more than you do. Yet my people stopped using dragons to conduct our wars for a reason, she stressed. As dangerous as they are to an enemy, they are nearly as dangerous to a friend. They are difficult to control, unless one does invest the time and effort. But in the end, we gave up our weapons to ensure our future. To bring them back again, even with such a pretext, she said, shaking her head.
I cannot help but be wary.
Wary you should be, my lady, I nodded. Yet when a dragon attacked Castle Cambrian and reduced it to rubble, it might have been helpful to have our own dragon around to contest the battle.
5 times or more have we faced the beasts on the field. Only 3 have left their skulls behind in token of our ability to contend with them. If we have these assets, then I move that we deploy them, else our dragon-slaying efforts will be pointless.
I will accept these eggs on behalf of my sisters,
Falowin agreed. I do not know if we can hatch them and bring them to maturity, but it is within their right to try.
If not, I added, no doubt I could get a pretty fair bit of silver for one on the black market,
I said in a hoarse whisper.
You will not sell a viable dragon's egg to some idiot human, exploded Mycrethiel. If assigning the emissaries to them will keep you from such madness, so be it. But to even threaten to let your warrior princes bid for such dangerous things, it belies reason,
she snorted.
Then it's settled, Pentandra said sweetly. Minolan's 2 eggs will be given to the Terra Alon.
That is hardly a scandal, my lady, she added to Mycrethiel.
That depends entirely on how you were raised, she sniffed. But I suppose once we allowed you people Irionite, it was only a matter of time before you overstepped your bounds. Now you seduce our youth with your ways and want them to raise dragons, she said in disgust. Must we adopt the means of our enemy to defeat that enemy?
No, I countered, but one doesn't leave a shiny new silver penny on the road if fortune puts it in your path. The Terra Alon will have the dragon eggs. Let's see what they can do with them. I took the brief space before dinner to walk the grounds of Carnaduin. The place was as beautiful in the dead of winter as it was in spring or summer, I saw. Just a different variety of beauty. Fresh fallen snow coated every tree, cottage, and shrub, and gave the long, deep valley a beautiful mantle. The singing continued the entire time we were there. When I discovered I had a moment to myself before the inevitable banquet, I took a stroll and lit my pipe.
Beautiful view from here,
Brigger said a moment later. I wasn't particularly surprised by her appearance, but then I wasn't expecting it either.
Minolan, I'm sorry about the exile, she began. That took us by surprise. There wasn't really much we could do about it save send the man some persuasive dreams. Well, they were supposed to be persuasive, she amended.
Don't worry about it, I dismissed, enjoying the taste of the smoke on my tongue as it mixed with the cold, wet air. 7 Dor is in good hands. It's protected. The kingdom is united. Alia's back, more or less. Exile is a small price to pay for all of that.
It will be good, I promise, she encouraged.
There are a lot of exciting things happening at Vanador, and they're only going to get better. You should see what the Dradrian are doing. This time next year, they'll be producing magical blades that will make Master Cormoran's look cheap in comparison, she pledged.
And you can build a new Bouliaterion there, she said, encouragingly.
I will, I agreed. I will do all of that, and more. I'm actually looking forward to it, I admitted. It's time for life to slow down and let me enjoy it for a change. You know, since I discovered that the Aronin poisoned my perceptions when it came to Shirul, I've been resenting it. He meant well, I suppose, but the fact is that he took away my right to choose to fight. I'd like to get that back. He compelled me to rush around and get a bunch of people killed, and while a lot of good came out of it, well, I think I didn't deserve that awful responsibility in the first place.
Minolan, you aren't considering abandoning?
No, no. Korbal and Shirul must be fought, and they must be defeated, I agreed. I'm not backing away from that, but I am willing to let others take up more of the fight. I'm more than 30 years old now, and I won't be getting less old.
Don't be so certain of that,
Brigger said, biting her lip. What do you mean?
You know how that thing keeps bonding with you, or however you describe it when you use it?
She asked, pointing to the megalith.
She's changing you. Changing you and Alia.
Changing us how?
I feel fine. I have no doubt,
she conceded.
I didn't say she was harming you. I would say rather that she is improving you.
I need improvement.
Would you have invented gods if you were perfect?
There's plenty of inefficiencies in your bodies and souls, Minolan.
I think the handmaiden is smoothing them out, in your case, like making bread into balls. She's smoothing and kneading you, making you better, to her eye. I don't think she has an eye, but she has perspective, Brigger pointed out. I noticed how her footprints steamed in the cold as they melted the snow. That was adorable, for some reason. And it's not a human perspective. When she saw the Celestial Mother, she went to work. She's been continuing to work at a distance this entire time. What? How? Falahudi Stone, remember? The Fire Goddess pointed out. She has direct contact with the snowflake. She's using it, too. On it, on Alia, and now on you. I think she's looking at you as a pattern for Alia, because she has no idea what it means to be human, and I think she's making some intriguing artistic choices in how she's altering you both, she offered. For instance, your guilt and shame have decreased dramatically. You are more confident and less prone to emotional outbursts. You are more insightful and less inclined to frustration. I think you've been inhaling a little too much smoke, goddess, I chuckled. I'm just as frustrated as ever. But you aren't frustrated with yourself anymore, Minilin, she countered. You have no idea how painful that is to watch. When you hold yourself up to a standard and fail to reach it, you are brutal on yourself, and that has an effect on everything you do. Everything I do works pretty well, I said defensively. It has, so far, she agreed. But what has it cost you? Think of the grief you bore over Isili and her children. While it is still there, you have a much more reasonable perspective on them now. You tortured yourself with that, and then with losing Alia. But if I hadn't, I never would have sought the handmaiden, I pointed out. I'm aware of basic causality, thank you, she frowned. The issue is not your motivation, Minilin. It's your self-perception. You don't hate yourself the way you did, even after learning what the Aronin did to you. She's helping you with that. I still hate myself, I confided, but don't tell anyone. I hate myself because I made so many mistakes along the way. Stupid mistakes. I learned a lot from them, but a lot of people suffered for it, and that is my responsibility. Well, maybe she'll keep working on that for you, Brigger decided, after regarding me silently for just a little too long. As long as she keeps bringing Alia back, I'm happy. That's my reward. I can hate myself all I want because I love her. Humans are weird, she said, rolling her eyes. Yes, yes, we are, I sighed, weird and unpredictable. That's why we need the gods. I'll make a note of that. Speaking of which, Harris says he'll have more candidates for you come late spring. He has a line on a couple of interesting prospects, including Avital, if all goes well. Avital? That would be helpful. Anyone else? He's talking to some sea gods, but it's hard to get a straight answer out of them. They're notoriously fickle, like all elemental divinities. I thought you were an elemental divinity, so don't piss me off, she agreed. I could turn on you like that, she snapped. Oh, and Ishi thinks she can convince a goddess named Nykura to consider it. She's a Cormiran folk goddess, but one of her specialties is magic. And death. And necromancy. She sounds charming, I said sarcastically, but we need all the help we can get. I'll talk to her. Good. Now, about the Vundel, she said hesitantly. I groaned. What about the Vundel? Do they have a god they want to propose? You don't want to know what they consider a god. Actually, you have one in your cellar. No, the Vundel are going to be wanting more snowstone men. A lot more. When they contact you this spring, they're going to tell you that the Great Reefs grew more than they have in 10 millennia in one summer, thanks to the powdered snowstone they seeded it with. Well, I'm glad it worked out for them, I said. But we have a limited supply. That's what I'm trying to tell you, Min, Brigger sighed. They won't accept that as an answer. They want more. They'll take more. They'll take it all, if they have to. Or we can figure out what happened that night and see if we can't recreate the effect. That will mean an unfortunate exploration of Dunsellan's files, I nodded. He was working on that when he died. He and Easily. See? You said that and didn't even want to curl up in the fetal position. That's progress. I ignored her. He did quite a lot of work in that, actually. All morally suspect, of course. But perhaps we can learn something from his criminal acts to make up for them in some small way. I'll put Taran on it, I decided. He's already at Greenflower, and I think he'd like a job that didn't involve too many dead people. Just figure it out, she commanded. They are going to ask for more. Then they are going to demand it. They can be a very impatient race for immortals, but you have given them hope that they haven't had since the last of the Celestial Mothers perished. Those corals don't just grow like that anymore, Min, and the Vandal are utterly dependent upon them. Their entire culture is based around their conservation. Now, you've shown them that it's possible to expand their corals in the most polluted, damaged waters on Kalidor. That is going to, excuse the expression, light a fire under the sea folk like you have never seen. It's on my list, I promised. Right up there with finding the ancient arsenal and kicking Corbel back into the nearest convenient hole. But I'm not going to kill myself over it, I informed her. I've done my time, as foot soldier, commander, baron, and now count. I never asked for any of it. The gods don't usually ask, she observed. The gods can jump into the chamber pot then, I said flatly. I'll do my part, but I've already done my part, if you take my meaning. I am not the only heroic bastard in the world. No, but you're the most talented one we have, she said, shaking her head. Right now you are the center point, holding this entire mess together. This new Berrien, the Alka Alon, the Terra Alon, the Kingdom, a couple of duchies, the Magi, the Order of the Secret Tower. Everything is in your lap. For the moment, you are indispensable. Bullshit, I declared, but I knew she was right. That was what was really depressing about the conversation. I couldn't realistically argue against what she was saying. In trying to save my family and preserve my marriage, I'd inadvertently made myself indispensable. It wasn't a good feeling. I vowed to make myself dispensable as quickly as I could. I wouldn't worry about it too much, Min, she said at last. If nothing else, you have the favor of the gods. That has to count for something. That's what I keep telling myself. I'm also trying to convince myself that that's a good thing. It is, for now. Even Ishii likes you. Ishii likes everyone, male, I pointed out. Not everyone. She's actually quite picky. But you intrigue her. A mortal who's willing to contend with her is a rare treat. She likes a good fight. As much of a pain in the ass as she is, though, she has been helpful in a limited sort of way. Alia and I are together again. That's all the help I needed from her. And Trigg? Trigg loves us all. That's her job. She's all mother. But I think Sisu respects you. He's hard to impress. Oh, good. That would be a blessing, if I hunted. At least Hera seems to favor me, without any preconditions. You do walk a lot, or did, before you learned about the ways. I think it has more to do with my generous nature, I chuckled. He knows he can drink for free in Sevendor. All of this is very intriguing, in a theological sort of way. But while I value the favor of the gods, I still don't know how it's supposed to allow me to get everything done that I need to.
Neither do we, Brigger shrugged. That's why we have mortals.
Chapter 80 Forseti. Spring was threatening to break out across the land, and the days before Brigger's Day were growing fewer. Since the Council of Berrien met, I'd spent every waking moment overseeing the packing. Most of our possessions could be stuffed in a hoxter and forgotten about, but not everything. The dogs, for instance, and the children, and a lot of my laboratory equipment. I wasn't taking everything, but I had a chance to rebuild a new lab in Vanador, and I wanted to ensure it was as modern and well-equipped as befitted the Count Palatine of the Mage Law. I was surprised to learn that my father made the journey all the way back from Talrion Burin with three of his apprentices and two wagons, determined to cart my belongings over the road from Sevendor all the way up to the Wilderlands. This was a man who had never ventured more than 150 miles from his home before.
but when he discovered that his son had been sent into exile, he didn't hesitate. He came to help, no matter that I had hundreds of servants and retainers willing to obey my every command. Dad is just like that. If one of his kids needs help, then he doesn't mess around. He makes sure it gets done. I didn't even have the benefit of two apprentices anymore. Dara passed her examinations at Yule with highest marks. I was down to Ruderal, and while he was extremely helpful, it felt odd to have to rely upon him alone now. Bannermord had stopped by to help, which was merely an excuse for him to bend my ear with last-minute details, mostly about the Arcane Mercantile Company. I was to head up the Vanador station house for the company, and he wanted to make certain that I properly understood what that entailed. With the Count of the Seahold empowered to build a new Royal Navy, timber sales just went through the tower roof, he assured me. All that old stock Anguin had laying around is gone. Shipwrights are paying top prices for Alshari lumber again, and that goes double for Alshari iron and lead. The faster you can get a warehouse constructed, the sooner we can start purchasing timber and making a, well, about a 500% profit, once all the potential taxes and fees for transport we aren't paying are factored in. If Alshari timber starts showing up in large quantities at markets without paying tax on it at the gate, people are going to start to ask questions, I pointed out. Which is why Count Markadine has already sent three caravans of timber south, culled from the Penumbra lands he no longer controls, and he's using magi to kiln and mill it, just as we are. So when those caravans hit, no one will be counting how many board feet are being sold and comparing it to how many were taxed. And iron? Iron is easier, he shrugged. Once you melt it down, it's hard to track. We'll send some ore overland, too, to throw Tavard's tax collectors off the trail. That's all very interesting, I agreed, as I packed away my thaumaturgical wands in a crate. But I'm not going to Vanador to become a merchant prince. But why not dabble a little while you're there? Bannermore reasoned. With you in the background, hire whomever you wish to actually run the show. No one is going to try to cheat the spellmonger. One would hope, I agreed. But my time will be taken up with research and developing the town and lands I've been entrusted. You run the town and the company. Make all the money you want while I'm gone. Just make sure the place is still here when I return. Oh, I have a sneaking suspicion you'll see Sevendor again before 3 years have passed, he chuckled. You can count on it, I agreed. I'm not going to turn my back on my own domain. I've already started working on a few things, and I don't think Tavard is going to be content to let Sevendor lie unmolested in my absence. When you pick enemies, you don't mess around, do you? He asked, with a mix of horror and admiration. Last I heard, he accused you of looting his treasury before you let his castle get destroyed. Looted is a loaded term, I snorted. That was a perfectly legitimate agreement on Moran's behalf, one that saved the lives of Castali's soldiers on foreign soil. From what I heard, Tavard reamed out Moran over it good, he chuckled. I paid every penny he demanded in compensation, I pointed out, as exorbitant as it was. For what? This old junk? He asked, as he surveyed the pile of teka Ruderal had yet to pack up. It's not junk. It's invaluable. And no, most of that was from my own original collection. Parts of it came to me by way of Shuru's favourite ancient cavern itself. The stuff I took from Tavard was far more impressive. What is all of this supposed to do? He asked.
Mostly, it writes long series of numbers, Ruderal supplied. I've been writing them down as they change. Lady Lelastian says that the teka is initializing.
And that means? He asked.
I have no idea,
Ruderal admitted,
but it sounds important.
Spoken like a law, brother, chuckled the mayor, looking over the equipment dubiously.
It's not even pretty. What do people collect it?
It's a remnant from our past, I explained. Once, our ancestors' entire civilization depended on such things. Lelastian says it was quite a sight to see in its day.
No doubt,
Bannermore said skeptically as he studied the pile. My ancient Perwanese is crap, he admitted, but I think this thing wants your attention. It says, press key.
Ishi's tits, this is hard.
He leaned on one of the devices as he tried to get a better look at the shiny band that Ruderal had been faithfully recording from. And something happened. There was a strange chime in the room, and then some whirring. I stopped packing and approached the workbench, which Bannermore had leapt back from the moment he realized he'd touched something.
"Harris! Banyans! What did I do?"
he swore, his eyes wide.
"Relax. It makes noises all the time,"
Ruderal assured the older man. "It's... well, this is new," he said, as he glanced at the strip.
"The Lastian mentioned this might happen."
"What? What?" Bannermore asked, growing more alarmed.
"Bide,"
my apprentice said unhelpfully, as he consulted a scroll of notes.
"I've been working on this a while. Let's see. We should try this,"
he decided, resolutely touching one of the devices.
"Thank you, Ruderal,"
an inhuman voice said. It seemed to come from everywhere. "Now I can speak to you directly."
Who are you?"
he asked.
"And how do you know my name?"
"I have been listening to every conversation in this room for over a year," the voice explained. "It took me a while to correct my translation algorithm to adjust to linguistic drift, and then longer still to assemble an adequate vocabulary. But it was futile until the interface was repaired."
"I think we're still waiting for an explanation of just who you are and where you are," I suggested.
"As to where I am, I believe it is in the Tower of Minnelan the Spellmonger, Baron of Sevendor, which I assume is the northern end of the Uwari mountain chain. At least, that is what I have been able to determine through analysis of your casual conversations. More specifically, I am a collection of devices sitting on a work table directly in front of you. As for who I am, that is easier to tell you, but more difficult to explain. I am a data analysis tool and interface system developed for the Kalador Colonial Survey Corps to facilitate the placement of terraforming elements during initial colonization. I was assigned to Markus Josef Steinmeier, Assistant Chief Engineer for the Western Region Wilderness Reserve Sedimentation and Erosion Control Project."
"That tells us very little," I suggested apologetically, "and I regret to inform you that your previous human is dead."
"I surmised as much from the passage of time,"
the machine said. "From what I can ascertain, it has been 724 years since my systems went dormant. That may be inaccurate by up to 7%, it warned. "Most of my data input streams are compromised."
"That sounds about right," I agreed. "Did you have a name when you worked with your previous master?"
"While not all units were anthropomorphized by their users during the colonization, as many remote agents did, Marcus programmed me to respond to his personal parameters when we were in the field to ease use. He chose to call me Forseti, after a mythological figure from his homeland on Terra."
"Forseti it is then," I continued. "I am, as you have acknowledged, Minnelan the Spellmonger, Baron of this land, until recently. With me is Ruderal, my apprentice, and Lord Mayor Bannermore, a business associate."
"I am familiar with both entities by their voices,"
agreed Forseti.
"A pleasure to be officially introduced to you, gentlemen."
"Forseti, your mastery of Narasi is impressive," I said, intrigued at the novelty of the situation.
"It is not too dissimilar to the original language groups of the colony, allowing for natural drift. I take it you are emerging from an era of rank illiteracy?"
"Compared to our ancestors, yes," I agreed. "But we're working on it.
I have access to nearly 7 million terabytes of data in my personal memory. Much of it you may find useful in that endeavor. In fact, there are many ways in which I might be able to assist you in improving the lot of the colonists."
"You have an interest in such things?" Bannermore asked, surprised.
"My primary programming places the survival and prosperity of the Kalador colony as paramount,"
Forseti explained.
"In the face of a cataclysmic crisis, all secondary purposes are suspended until the emergency has passed. I am extremely concerned with the continued survival of the human colonists, therefore."
"Excellent," I said, clapping my hands, "because we have need of such counsels. Our civilization is threatened by dark forces, even genocidal forces. Most of our advanced civilization is gone. What remains resides in dark, dusty corners, while the people toil. We need help, I said simply.
I am here to provide help for the colony, agreed Fossetti. It is my primary purpose. I will be glad to assist you in that process. But it is imperative that our goals be understood at the beginning of such a relationship.
The survival of the human race on Kalador seems a simple goal, I agreed.
The goal is the survival of the colony, and as many colonists as possible, corrected Fossetti.
All of the colonists, agreed. I am not here on behalf of my own land, or even the kingdom, but on humanity's behalf.
Excellent. Then you will have my assistance.
In the short term, I will guide you as best I can, with the limited resources at my disposal.
In the moderate term, we will design and construct industries and institutions to fulfill the purposes of adequate colonial administration.
In the long term, we will ascertain the feasibility of reclaiming lost colonial elements and resources. All of that sounds... Actually, I didn't understand all of it, I admitted, but yes. Let's see if we can't reignite human civilization here on Kalador, I agreed excitedly.
The foremost goal, then, should be the discovery and disposition of the remainder of the stasis-bound colonists. From my understanding of the conversations I have overheard, their disposition is of the utmost importance for this purpose. An injection of highly educated, highly skilled professionals into the colony is the most expedient route to recovering the basic fundamentals of advanced industrial civilization.
As the largest pool of such professionals is likely still in stasis, their recovery is of vital importance.
Just what does all that mean?
Bannermore asked, confused.
It means, Lord Mayor Bannermore, that the simplest way to rectify the current cataclysmic status of human civilization in the colony is to essentially restart the basic colonial process from the beginning.
You mean, I asked, the implications of what the machine was suggesting starting to occur to me.
I mean, Minnalan, the spellmonger, that humanity's best hope for survival on Kalador is for you to find and awaken the ones you call the Forsaken. Without their assistance and direction, I see little chance of the colony's survival. Almost none.
This is the end of Necromancer, a Podium audio production. If you enjoyed this audiobook, we would love for you to rate and review it. For more epic fantasy adventures, check us out at podiumaudio.com and sign up for our newsletter. We promise we won't spam you. Also, consider joining our community of listeners, fans, and trolls on social media. We're active on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Discord. We'd love to connect. You have been listening to Necromancer, Book 10 of the Spellmonger series, produced by Emily Durr, written by Terry Mancor, performed by John Lee. Text copyright 2019 by Terry Mancor. Production copyright 2020 by Podium Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.